Play one.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Armin Kasabian, Alice Bryant, and Dan Friedel. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Armin Kasabian.
Two Iraqi women are working as engineers in Iraq's oil industry to help develop their country's economy. Zainab Amjad is a 24-year-old engineer who works on an oil rig for 6 weeks at a time. The rig is where companies drill deep into the ground to look for oil. Amjad said she is often asked what she is doing in the oil fields. "They tell me the field environment only men can withstand," said Amjad. "If I gave up, I'd prove them right." Ayat Rothan is a 24-year-old engineer working in another oil rig in Basra. She supervises a team that prepares large drill pipes used to collect information about rock formations. Most women who are petroleum engineers in Iraq work in an office. Instead, Amjad and Rothan chose to work in the oil fields. "These are not usual jobs for women from conservative communities. Petrochemical programs in the country's engineering schools are for students with the best grades. Both women were in the top 5% of their graduating class at Basra University in 2018. They are part of a new generation of Iraqi women who are going against tribal traditions. "Many times, my professors laughed, 'Sure, we'll see you out there,' telling me I wouldn't be able to make it," said Rothan. "But this only pushed me harder." Rothan's parents supported and understood her interests. She hopes to help establish a labor rights group for Iraqi female engineers in the future. The oil industry is an important source of income for the government in Iraq. It supports the country's development after years of conflict. Amjad is the daughter of two doctors. She knew she had to work for an international oil company because state-owned companies would only permit her to work in an office. "In my free time, on my vacations, days off, I was booking trainings, signing up for any program I could," said Amjad. Amjad first worked for China Petroleum Engineering and Construction Corporation and later for the U.S.-based Schlumberger Company as an engineer. She passed one difficult test after another. Asked if she was sure she could do the job, she said, "Hire me, watch." Rothan, too, knew she would have to work extra hard to succeed. Once, when her team had to perform a difficult task, she stayed awake all night. "I didn't sleep for 24 hours. I wanted to understand the whole process, all the tools, from beginning to end," she said. Rothan now works for Schlumberger, where she collects information from oil wells. She wants to learn drilling, and the company is a worldwide leader in the service. Not only have Amjad and Rauthan faced inequality within the industry, they also face ongoing protests by local tribes and violence towards oil workers. But the two women are willing to take on difficulties, such as state corruption, poor services, and high unemployment. Amjad said she has little time to even consider these difficulties, for even at night she is often working. The drilling never stops, she said. I'm Armin Kasabian.
Lawmakers in the American state of Mississippi passed a measure last week to ban transgender athletes from joining competitive female sports teams. Similar bills are under consideration in more than 20 legislatures around the United States. Supporters of the proposed bans say transgender girls are naturally stronger and faster because they are biologically male. They argue this gives them an unfair edge over competitors born as girls. The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, is an organization that supports and defends individual rights. The organization called the proposed bans a coordinated attack on trans student athletes. It said the proposed laws discriminate against trans youth in ways that compromise their health, social and emotional development, and safety. They also raise a host of privacy concerns. The proposed state bans, supported by Republicans, could go against part of a federal education law barring sex discrimination and high court rulings on the issue. In addition, others say an executive order signed by President Joe Biden, a Democrat, bars discrimination based on gender identity in school sports and elsewhere.
Nationwide, 19 American states permit full inclusion of trans athletes. 16 have no clear state policy. 7 require trans girls to take female hormones. And 8 ban trans girls from girls' teams. That information comes from the National Center for Lesbian Rights. There is no official count of how many trans athletes have competed in high school or college sports. State high school and college athletic associations do not collect that information. In states that do collect it, the numbers are low. No more than 5 students currently in Kansas and 9 in Ohio over 5 years. Transgender adults make up a small percentage of the U.S. population, about 1.3 million as of 2016. That information comes from the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law that specializes in research on LGBTQ issues. People who oppose the growing attention and rights for transgender people, though, say that new laws are needed to keep the sports fair for cisgender girls. In Connecticut, a federal court is hearing a legal action seeking to block transgender girls from participating in girls' sports. It centers on two transgender girl sprinters, Terry Miller and Andrea Yearwood. They have often performed better than their cisgender competitors. When the law does not recognize differences between men and women, we've seen that women lose, said Christiana Holcomb. She is a lawyer for the Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF, which filed the legal action in February 2020. The ADF and groups like it are helping the ban campaigns of lawmakers. When asked for other examples of complaints about middle or high school transgender athletes, ban supporters gave two. One involved a Hawaii female coach who complained last year over a trans girl competing in girls' sports. The other involved a cisgender girl in Alaska who defeated a trans runner in 2016. She said the trans girl's third place finish was unfair to runners who were further behind. Only one state, Idaho, has enacted a law limiting trans students' sports participation, and that 2020 measure was blocked by a court ruling.
The bills under consideration by state legislatures this year, however, could prove harmful for transgender athletes. In Utah, a 12-year-old transgender girl cried when she heard about the proposal, which would separate her from her friends. She is shorter than some of the other girls on the swim team and has worked hard to improve her times, her coach said. But she is not the strongest swimmer in her age group. Other than body parts, I've been a girl my whole life, she said. The girl and her family spoke with the Associated Press on the condition that her name not be shared publicly. In New Jersey, 14-year-old Rebecca Breezehoff competes on her middle school field hockey team. I know what it's like to have my gender questioned, Rebecca said. I don't want others to go through that. New Jersey has a trans-inclusive sports policy. But other states could force athletes to take tests to prove their gender. That was one of the reasons 17-year-old Truman Hamburger protested a bill before the North Dakota legislature. Once you open up that door on gender policing, that's not a door you can easily close, he said. Sarah Huckman is a 20-year-old student at the University of New Hampshire. She competed in running for 3 years after coming out as trans in the seventh grade. The proposed bans sicken her. We're all human beings, she said. We do sports for the love of it. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol.
Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the Korean War. The biggest problem facing Dwight Eisenhower when he became President of the United States was the continuing conflict in Korea. Eisenhower was elected in November 1952. At the time, the United States had been helping South Korea fight North Korea for more than 2 years. About 20 other members of the United Nations were also helping the South. The UN members provided troops, equipment, and medical aid.
I shall go to Korea.
During the American presidential election campaign, Eisenhower announced that he would go to Korea. He thought such a trip would help end the war. Eisenhower kept his promise. He went to Korea after he won the election, but before he was sworn in as president. Yet the fighting did not stop in Korea until July of the next year, 1953. The war started when North Korean troops invaded South Korea. Both sides believed they should control all of the country. The dream of a united Korea was a powerful one. From 1910 until World War II, Korea had been under Japanese rule. In an agreement at the end of the war, troops from the Soviet Union occupied the North. They accepted the surrender of Japanese troops and set up a military government. American troops did the same in the South. The border dividing North and South was the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. A few years later, the United Nations General Assembly ordered free elections for all of Korea. With UN help, the South established the Republic of Korea. Syngman Rhee was elected the first president. On the other side of the 38th parallel, however, Soviet troops refused to let UN election officials enter the North. The Soviet Union supported the creation of a communist government there called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Kim Il-sung was named premier. Five years after the end of World War II, the United States had withdrawn almost all of its troops from South Korea. It was not clear if America would defend the South from attack. South Korea had an army, but it was smaller and less powerful than the North Korean army. North Korea decided the time was right to invade. On June 25, 1950, North Korean soldiers crossed the 38th parallel. The UN Security Council demanded that they go back. 2 days later, the council approved military support for South Korea. The Soviet delegate boycotted the meeting that day. If he had been present, the resolution would have been defeated. The UN demand did not stop the North Korean troops. They continued to push south. In a week, they were at the edge of the capital, Seoul. Harry Truman, America's president at that time, ordered air and sea support for South Korea. A few days later, he announced that American ground forces would also be sent. Truman wanted an American to command UN troops in Korea. The UN approved his choice, General Douglas MacArthur. Week after week, more UN forces arrived in the south. Yet by August, they had been pushed back to the Pusan perimeter. This was a battle line around an area near the city of Pusan in the southeast corner of Korea. North Korean forces attempted to break through the Pusan perimeter. They began a major attack on August 6th. They lost many men, however, and by the end of the month, they withdrew. The next month, General MacArthur directed a surprise landing of American Marines in South Korea. They arrived at the port of Incheon on the northwest coast. The landing was extremely dangerous. Water levels could rise or fall as much as 9 meters in a single day. The boats had to get close to the coastline and land at high tide. If they waited too long, the water level would drop and they would be trapped in the mud with little protection. The soldiers on the boats would be easy targets. The landing at Incheon was successful. The additional troops quickly divided the North Korean forces, which had been stretched from north to south. At the same time, UN air and sea power destroyed the Northern Army's lines of communication. On October 1st, South Korean troops entered North Korea. They captured the capital, Pyongyang. Then they moved toward the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China. China warned against moving closer to the border. General MacArthur ordered the troops to continue their attacks. He repeatedly said he did not believe that China would enter the war in force. MacArthur was wrong. Several hundred thousand Chinese soldiers crossed into North Korea in October and November. Still, MacArthur thought the war would end by December 25th, the Christmas holiday. This was not to happen. The UN troops were forced to withdraw from Pyongyang. And by the day before Christmas, there had been a huge withdrawal by sea from the coastal city of Hongnam. In the first days of 1951, the North Koreans recaptured Seoul. The UN troops withdrew about 40 kilometers south of the city. They reorganized and 2 months later regained control of Seoul. Then the war changed. The two sides began fighting in an area north of the 38th parallel. They exchanged control of the same territory over and over again. Men were dying, but no one was winning. The cost in lives was huge. General MacArthur had wanted to enter China and attack Manchuria. He also had wanted to use nationalist Chinese troops against the communists. President Truman feared that these actions might start another world war.
If we do have another world war, it will be an atomic war. We could expect many atomic bombs to be dropped on American cities. and a single one of them could cause many more times the casualties than we have suffered in all the fighting in Korea. I do not want to be responsible for bringing that about.
When MacArthur disagreed in public with the president's policies on Korea, including the general's statement, "There is no substitute for victory," Truman dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In June 1951, the Soviet delegate to the United Nations proposed a ceasefire for Korea. Peace talks began, first at Kaesong, then at Panmunjom. By November, hope for a settlement was strong. But negotiators could not agree about several issues, including the return of prisoners. The UN demanded that prisoners of war be permitted to choose if they wanted to go home. The different issues could not be settled after more than a year. Finally, in November 1952, the peace talks were suspended. Fighting continued during the negotiations. As it did, President Truman lost support. This was one reason why he decided not to seek re-election. The new president, Dwight Eisenhower, took office in January 1953. Eisenhower had campaigned to end the war. He was willing to take strong action to do this. Years later, he wrote that he secretly threatened to expand the war and use nuclear weapons if the Soviets did not help restart the peace talks. Such measures were not necessary. In a few months, North Korea accepted an earlier UN offer to trade prisoners who were sick or wounded. The two sides finally signed an armistice agreement on July 27, 1953. The agreement stopped the fighting and provided for the exchange of about 90,000 prisoners of war. It also permitted prisoners to choose if they wanted to go home. The war in Korea damaged almost all of the country. As many as 2 million people may have died, including many civilians. After the war, the United States provided hundreds of thousands of soldiers to help the South guard against attack from the North. Half a century has passed since the truce, yet Korea is still divided, and many of the same issues still threaten the Korean people and the world. The Korean conflict increased efforts in the United States to develop a weapon more deadly than the atomic bombs that had been used against Japan to end World War II. These efforts led to the hydrogen bomb. The Soviets were developing such a weapon, too. They had already developed and tested an atomic bomb. The 1950s found Americans at home feeling hopeful about the economic future while also living under the threat of nuclear war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.